for members only. Golf Smarter number 184 for June 23, 2009.
smarterpodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Top 100 instructor Tommy Masters.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome, and thanks for checking in. Okay, I've booked my tickets and really hope that you will seriously consider joining us for the very first Golf Smarter Golf Adventure when we play for 3 days in Prague, Czech Republic this September. Since we published that special episode with all the details last week, we've added pricing for non-golfing partners. My wife is coming and is not going to play because she's more interested in additional touring, spas, and shopping. So I hope this makes it a little more appealing to you as well. I really don't expect the bulk of our group will be listeners based in North America, Asia, or Australia. But if you're already in Europe, this is just a long weekend trip and a great way for us to meet. Oh, did I also mention that one of our group dinners, we're going to be recording a future episode of the Golf Smarter podcast all together. And if you have questions, I invite you to bring those in too. Now, the ultimate goal here is twofold: to play golf with you somewhere, somehow, and to get our global online community, who clearly has a shared passion, get you offline, especially those of you who live in close proximity to one another, so that you can meet, play together, and discuss what you've picked up from Golf Smarter. I know it's a big task, but so is getting up in the morning, and we're here, right? Okay. Our guest today came to us from a Golf Smarter member, Jimmy Masters, whose brother has been named multiple times as a top 100 instructor by Golf Magazine, and whose client list includes PGA Tour player Nick Watney, Canadian Tour player Jason Higdon, and NFL quarterback Trent Dilfer. How's this for a great name for someone who makes a living in golf? Tommy Masters. Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Tommy.
Thanks, Fred. It's great to be a part of it.
Well, it's a joy to have you on because you've got stellar credentials, but the recommendation is what I really loved. I received an email from your brother, who's a Golf Smarter listener, but he's not been a golfer his whole life, has he? He's a new golfer.
He's a new golfer. That's my older brother, Jimmy. I have two older brothers, but a very accomplished musician by trade, and he got the golf bug, I would say, maybe 3 years ago, and had really never had played any, in the past, and now he's hooked.
Now, did you obviously didn't have a golf family? Did your father or your parents play golf as well?
My father was a golfer. He was a very good golfer, in fact, and a good athlete. Was an All-American baseball player at Boston College and was drafted. Hockey player as well, and he bought my mother a set of Patty Bergs, and they never got used, and I was about 10 years old, and I decided to take them out and give them a whirl, and that's how I got started. But my dad was an avid, couple times a week player, and didn't really push me to play, but thank goodness he bought my mom a set of clubs because that's what got me started.
Well, what a perfect name to have to be a golfer, Masters. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great one. I took my son actually last year to the Masters, so every time we went in the shop and spent money and I broke my credit card out, we had a lot of people talking to us.
Oh, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. So you are doing primarily instruction these days.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in Clovis, California. Share with us where Clovis is.
Well, the club I teach is in Fresno, California, the Central Valley, 120 miles north of Bakersfield and probably equal distance south of Sacramento.
Oh, I know we have listeners in Fresno, yeah.
At a wonderful private facility, San Joaquin Country Club. In fact, we hosted the Mid-Amateur some time ago, I think about 8 years ago maybe here. And I hold the title of director of instruction here. So I teach full-time.
And I see in your resume here that you also were an instructor at the Pebble Beach Golf Academy.
I was.
Why would you leave that?
Well, I finished a playing career in 1996, and my dear friend and mentor, Laird Small, is the director of the Pebble Beach Golf Academy, who actually worked with me when I played and have known him for 20 years. And I still do occasionally some corporate-type stuff in golf schools over there, but not as much as I used to. But that was my association, and you could still say I'm an associate instructor with them.
Laird Small is legendary as a golf instructor.
He is, and he's just been a dear friend, and we chat every week and share ideas, and you know, he's just been a great part of my life.
Fabulous. Well, let's talk about instruction for a while. We've received some questions from listeners, and I've had conversations with people who have some things that they would like to find out. But let's talk about when you're giving lessons. Most of the lessons that I see are, you know, on the driving range and, you know, working on swing mechanics and stuff. But I want to know about playing lessons, the value of playing lessons. You know, having the instructor going out with the golfer, do you find that there's value in doing playing lessons, or is it better just to work on swing mechanics?
No, tremendous value. You know, I one of the things I try and do with all my students, regardless of their skill level, is A, I tell them that golf is a unique sport. It's practiced in a completely different environment than it's played. And I try and get them to do one or two things, to certainly do a lot of simulated practice on the range to try and create that, you know, feel of being on the golf course. But every opportunity I have, which is really nice here at San Joaquin, because I can go out on the golf course a lot with a lot of my members and students, and I want to see them exposed out there. I want to see how they do out there and transfer skill sets from the range, so it's extremely important.
Yeah, it seems to be that there are a lot of scratch golfers on the driving range.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
but it doesn't always translate. Why? Why is it so difficult to take it from the range to the course?
Well, I think, again, that a lot of people are not taught how to practice effectively. I mean, they can go out there and repeat a motion and do something, but then give them one ball on the driving range, one target, make them go through their routine and see if they can execute it. And if they can't, then they have to continue to work on going through that process and being able to execute a golf shot. And, you know, the same thing when they go on the golf course. You know, they can't go out there. I'm an advocate of, I write a lot of notes to my students, you know, on what we've covered in a lesson. But I try and get them to go, okay, you can take one thing from the notes today and go to the golf course. You know, you can't sit out there with your Tommy notes over the golf ball. You have to go out there and learn to play golf and learn to execute a golf shot. And so I think it can be done in both environments. But, you know, I loved when Tiger came back at the match play, and the question was posed to him in an interview that you haven't competed in 10 months or whatever it may be, you know, how you think you're going to do? And he said, I've been competing for 2 months, which tells you the type of practice that he implements. He goes out and works on his mechanics, but he's out on the driving range, I know, recreating shots, going through his routine, and amateurs just don't practice that way.
What kind of advice would you provide to us to help us take that from the range to the course?
Well, I would say first you want to build a pre-shot routine that's very consistent. You know, if any of your listeners are tennis players, I'd ask them how many times do they bounce a tennis ball before they toss it to serve. Any former baseball players, what was their routine at the plate? Basketball player, two bounces, and, you know, most of them will come up and go, yeah, that's what I did. So I would first try and get them to develop a good pre-shot routine. And then I would get them to go out and work on mechanics. Maybe if they had an hour, they could do 20 minutes of mechanics, 20 minutes of hitting golf shots, maybe only get one shot to one flag. Also, a great thing is to play holes on the driving range to simulate a tee shot between, you know, two flags or whatever it may be. Let's say you slice it. So then the amateur has to go and, okay, I have to hit a low punch 4-iron and run it back into the fairway. Practicing more into that mentality and mindset will help them, so when they go to the golf course, it's not so foreign to transfer that skill set.
Where does the mental game fit into all of this?
Well, it should fit into your practice, certainly. And again, I think that's what's so important about having a good pre-shot routine is I tell a lot of my students that a lot of the players on TV, that's all they're paying attention to, is going through a step-by-step process, pre-shot routine, because, A, that can help clear your mind if you're nervous, anxious, or whatever it may be. But also on the driving range, I love to pay attention to my students and seeing how they react after a golf shot on the driving range. How are they emotionally? How do they recover? Certainly that gets much more exposed on the golf course. But again, I think practicing in this manner, trying to see how you feel after you hit a bad shot, take one practice swing that felt right, et cetera, that, you know, the mental, people can train their mental game, certainly in the practice facility. And I think most of them, again, are practicing their mechanics, but not necessarily practicing a routine or visualizing a golf shot. I mean, it's amazing. I've been on the golf course with 22 handicappers, and I've said, hit a high draw into that pin, and they'll look at me like I'm crazy. I'll go, just try it. Try and hook the ball. And if they sometimes picture it and just feel it, it surprises them that they could pull it off.
I would be surprised if you asked me to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, and do you forget it? Shaping the shots just ain't going to work with me. You mentioned that you like to see how they react in their practice on the range, and that tells you more about how they're going to react when they're on the course. What is it specifically that you're looking for or you're looking at?
Well, A, you know, I tell people that emotions, fear, hate, anger, lust, et cetera, come on us in a moment. You know, we see a good-looking lady. We see something that scares us. Fear strikes us instantly. We don't know where it comes from. But then it's our job to decide how long we want to hold on to that or what we can do with that. So in golf, you miss a bad shot, anger shows up immediately, a la Tiger Woods. He expresses his anger, but he lets go very rapidly, obviously, and then gets excited to go hit his next golf shot. And I think that most amateurs need, you know, regardless of how they react after a golf shot, understand the importance of, okay, you know, that's done. All I can do now is go pay attention to my next golf shot. And sometimes, you know, a lot of my junior players will miss a shot. They throw the club in the bag, and I watch them walk down the fairway, their shoulders slumped, and if you watch Tiger again, miss a shot, might bury the club in the turf, say a bad word, but if the camera stays on there, he usually rehearses a golf swing like he wanted to make. Then he tosses the club to his caddy and moves forward. So those things, you know, pre-shot routine, what we do before we hit a shot, but I think what we do and how we react and handle what we do after we hit a golf shot are equally important.
I was just making a note before you said that to ask you about the importance of a pre-shot routine. You've definitely laid out for us, but the importance of a post-shot routine. I know that Glenn Allbaugh, I've talked to him about a post-shot routine, and I'm sure you've worked with Glenn. But the post-shot routine, the importance of that, and how to develop one without letting your emotions get in the way of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and that Glenn, I was going to go right there, is another very dear, close friend and has been a great mentor in that department on, you know, sometimes I think they call it an anchor as well after you hit a shot, but he's been instrumental in educating me on the importance of what we do after we hit a golf shot. And everyone is different. Everyone reacts different, handles it different. But again, to most of your listeners and the amateurs out there, I'd say when you're practicing, again, that's a great thing to be paying attention to, building a routine, hitting a shot, seeing how you react. If you're taking lessons and you have a certain swing feel that you need, well, maybe you just replenish it after that bad shot, which will help you prepare for your next shot.
So interesting and so important.
I think one of the other things is that you have to, in this sport, you are going to miss a lot of golf shots. I try and get everyone to be as excited as they can to go hunt that ball down and see what they can do with it on the next shot. That's how I love to play the game. And we are in an era of watching a gentleman play golf from all over the planet, and probably the best player that we'll all ever see in our lifetime, which is Tiger Woods. And I think he just really embraces going in the trees, going in the rough, going wherever he may be, and going, you know, I'm still going to beat these guys' brains in, and I can't hit it in the fairway today. And so I think amateurs need to look at it. A, you're going to miss a lot of shots, but if you have an attitude, okay, this is exciting. Let me go in here and see what I can do. It really helps change your mindset.
I will definitely testify to that. I know that there are times when I play, when I hit it in the bunker, and I'll laugh about it and saying, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm going to enjoy this. I have much better results than if I get angry like, oh, that's not where I wanted the ball to go. Well, of course that's not where I wanted the ball to go. But if I just change the attitude on how I approach and what I want to do with it, it really makes a huge difference.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
I thought it was really interesting that you said how Tiger embraces it when he, you know, is putting himself all over the place, but and he gets himself into a difficult situation, he embraces it.
Yeah, that's my personal opinion, but I don't think there's any way he could do what he's done from the places he's played from if he had any other approach than that.
And
I think many of the other guys out there certainly play that way.
Yeah, yeah. Do you find that the young phenoms that are coming up and you know, these teenage players who can hit the ball a ton, have the ability to shape their shots and stick it where they want, do you think that their lack of maturity is the biggest hindrance to their greater success?
Junior players in general?
Oh, I'm talking about these young players that are just, you know, approaching the pro levels and playing in the bigger tournaments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the game has certainly changed so much that it's not as artistic as it used to be, but I think that is probably going to come back somewhat once they change the grooves on the tour and so forth, and guys are going to have to hit the ball in the fairway more. But there is, to me, the sad thing is I think there's an artistic element to the game that has certainly disappeared, not from a Tiger Woods or a Phil Mickelson, but my advice always to the younger players coming up is to learn to curve the ball and learn to hit at different heights and learn to hit at different distances, learn to hit a 7-iron 140 yards and hit it 150 and 160. And I'm very animate about teaching that up on the practice facility and so forth with most all of my juniors.
It's so interesting because it seems like when I'm watching people practice that they're trying to hit every club the maximum distance that they can. I'm just fascinated by the word that you used, artistic, and that they don't find better ways to use each club. They just want to get one use out of each of their clubs. Are you an advocate of carrying more wedges than, say, fairway woods or hybrids, so that you can be more consistent or give yourself more opportunities on the shorter shots?
Yeah, for a lot of players, I am. I think most amateurs today need to be top and bottom heavy. Plenty of stuff on the top, the hybrids and woods, and then plenty of stuff on the bottom, which would be wedges and gap wedges and so forth, because that's a majority of the clubs that they're going to hit. some people do better with one or two wedges and others four wedges perhaps. I think it's a great question and something that, most players should just go out there and explore and spend time with a golf professional and see if that fits into their, you know, their system, or they may do better with just one or two wedges and learning to adjust distances that way.
But are you also advocating reviewing your, say, your 5, 6, 7, maybe 8 irons and saying, okay, this is where if I have to eliminate a club, I should do it from this stretch of clubs?
Yes, usually the 5 iron.
Usually the 5 iron.
I haven't hit a 3 iron in 10 years, and my 4 iron's about ready to go because the hybrids are just so easy to hit.
Okay, there's some advice. That's good.
And the modern golf ball doesn't do what the old golf ball did. It's the other thing I also educate my students on is today's golf ball doesn't get in the air as quickly and easily as the old soft golf ball that spins. And that's one of the reasons you see even the best players in the world no longer carry. There's not many 2 irons out there left, and a lot of them not carrying 3 irons just because the golf ball they play does not get in the air as easy, and they're going to hybrids and 7 and 9 woods and lower center of gravity clubs. And a lot of the amateurs that are out there that don't have a lot of swing speed, then a 4 iron and a 5 iron, they don't have the speed to elevate the ball. But a 9 wood, 11 wood, a 25 degree hybrid has so much more loft, gets the ball in the air a lot quicker and easier.
Very interesting. Let me go to a question that we received from a listener, and they want to talk about technique and things like that. But we have another one that I'll get to later about having a golf school. But here's one from M. Shedlock of Lebanon, Pennsylvania, and he wants to talk about pitching technique. He said, ever since I had my left knee replaced, my pitching has become a disaster. I'll blade, chili dip, shank to the point where I've lost all of my confidence. I now use left arm only. At least I can put the ball on the green and hope to putt. Any advice would be appreciated.
Well, I would first, he's chipping left arm only.
Yeah.
I would try some right arm only as well, for starters. And then secondly, I would pose the question, when most people that I see when they're chipping, A, they tend to keep their body too still, focus too much on the golf ball, don't pay enough attention to rhythm and flow and allowing their body to turn back and turn through the golf shot even from 10, 15, 20 yards. And I think a good thing would be for this listener to go out and hit a full pitching wedge, whether it, say, hits at 100 yards. Then hit one 3/4, then hit one half, then hit one quarter swing, but still making the same motion, same movement pattern in his body and so forth, but just on a smaller scale. Because I see so many people that get into pitching and maybe not chip and run, but shorter chips, 20, 30-yard pitches, and a lot of my students, and for me in particular, I feel like that's the same motion as I make on a big swing. I don't get more still or use more arms, less body, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that would be a great place for him to start.
I also think that a very telling thing about his question was the fact that he recently had his left knee replaced. You advocate fitness on your website at TommyMasters.com. Maybe he needs to do some more rehab or get into a regular fitness situation program.
That could be. And maybe it's early post-surgery to where he might be tender and stiff still in his knee. But my experience with everyone that's had a knee replaced is their golf games get much, much better because they had it replaced because of pain and lack of movement, and they do such a great job on knee and hip replacement now that he's probably going to be a happy camper once it heals and he's feeling better. He's probably going to be able to move his knees better and move his body better with his new knee.
Well, Em, I hope you're doing well. I hope you recover well and keep us updated on how your game is going. Here's a question from Dana Olson of La Crosse, Wisconsin, saying that every time I see somebody showing how to hit a flop shot, it's normally fluffed up or at least a good lie in the rough. Is it possible to hit from the fairway grass, or if so, should you take a divot?
There's a great question. I am not a fan of a divot. What most amateurs don't understand, number one, is what bounce is on a golf club. And this could be an hour-long conversation, but that question, that listener should, A, go spend some time with a qualified golf instructor and have that instructor make them understand what bounce is. Because a sand wedge has a leading edge. It has the sole or the bottom of the club. And the bottom of the club is there for a reason. And if people learn to use the bottom of the club, then you can skim a golf ball off the tightest surface known to man. And that person, you know, wedge technology is tremendous now. There's wedges with different lofts, different grooves, and different bounces. And one of the things we do here is to go up and spend a lot of time with our students. We have wedges everywhere to try and find what the appropriate bounce to a wedge is. And to further that question, last year at the Masters, one of the things my son said to me early on is he said, "Dad, they don't take divots with their wedges around the greens." And I showed him the surface, and I said, "TJ, look how tight the surface is. It's like a putting green. And so you do not want to be coming in steep to that surface and taking a huge divot, because if you don't hit the back of the ball just right, you're in trouble." And what they do is they come in very shallow and underneath the golf ball and allowing the bounce to work.
Wow. That boy, you don't hear many people having that conversation about not taking a divot.
Yeah, and another great thing to do is to hit sand wedges like that off a tight lie with your right hand only. And that will help you feel that you could scoop the ball off the turf, because most people are taught to chip with their hands forward and their weight forward and come down and pinch the back of the golf ball. That is a wonderful way to chip and pitch. But you can also get the golf club to work underneath the ball, not having your hands forward. And you'll see articles. There was one last month with Jeff Ogilvy in Golf Digest hitting chips with his right hand and no divot and scooping the golf ball off tight turf. So that is permissible.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Eric Hernandez wanted to know, wanted me to ask you specifically about the best way to align yourself to the target. Now, he's not talking about hitting a draw or the fade. He just wants to stick it close. He says, "I know Butch Harmon talks about the railroad track visual, so I think that implies that the shoulder should be pointing to the flagstick. Now, don't train tracks look like they're getting closer together as they go farther away?" He says, "Sometimes after a round of golf, I feel like throwing myself on the train tracks, but that's a whole other issue."
Well, that goes back to, A, having a good pre-shot routine designed for aim and alignment. Using tools on the driving range, a club or two on the ground. But most amateurs that I see, when you ask them to hit a shot, they walk in and they align their body first. So first and foremost, I'm a huge advocate of when you walk in, setting the golf club in first to your intended target area and picking a spot maybe just in front of your ball. A divot, piece of grass is a wonderful way to work on aiming your club face properly, and then taking your stance and getting your body relatively square and in line with that. But again, if it's somebody who, you know, tends to shape the ball a certain way, slice and hook, well, then that aim may change a little bit more to the right or left. But in general, I think if you can get to where you're aiming the club face properly and your intent to your intended target, then simply just getting your feet and hips and shoulders in what I would call a square or aligned position to where the club face is, you're going to be in business.
Fabulous. All right, John Barton had a quick question. He says he's about to launch a golf school in Japan. What three pieces of advice would you give to someone with relatively little experience in that field? And the first one can't be don't do it.
No. Well, one would be to create a really, really great, the best learning environment he could create. From video equipment to the facility being in perhaps an isolated area that's not disturbed. Having all the tools and some training aids and so forth that you know, can help people better understand and maybe see and feel their golf swing. I think just the environment, the better the environment, the better the student, you know, the opportunity for them to learn. Number two would be to be as professional as you can be. Be very informative, create a very, very professional environment that's always on time. You know, treat people well, as you know, the service end of things are great, because people like to be treated well. They like to feel comfortable. So I think that's very important. And number three would be to be a great listener as well as a great talker. Make sure that, you know, when you do a golf school or you're teaching private or whatever it may be, that, you know, you listen to the students, you listen to their needs, and try and understand what they're bringing to you as much as what you're trying to bring to them.
Fabulous. Well, now we know why you've been named by Golf Magazine numerous times as one of the top instructors in the country. Tommy, these were great answers, and I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for coming on, and we advise everyone to check out for more information. Go to TommyMasters.com. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you, Fred.
And thank you, Jimmy. That was a good recommendation. Well, next week we're going to announce the winners of all of the Bobby Jones swag that Jesse Ortiz has offered. And as a member, you are automatically entered to win. Nothing more to do. Plus, a couple of the prizes have been specifically set aside for Golf Smarter members. But you can increase your chances of winning by entering again, because I will allow members to be entered twice when we do the drawing. Again, he's giving away a Bobby Jones driver in a cart bag, a fairway wood, a hybrid, and a Dave Pels wedge, all from Bobby Jones Golf. Great stuff from a great company. And if you've not done so yet, please write to the Bobby Jones Golf Company. Implore Jesse to become a regular on the Golf Smarter podcast. Send your email with the subject Golf Smarter Podcast to info@bobbyjonesgolf.net. And you can find that link right on the blog on our website. Now, since this is a members-only episode, I'm going to give away another autographed copy of last week's guest and NBC ESPN sportscaster Jimmy Roberts' book, Breaking the Slump. Congratulations, David Largent of Frederick, Maryland. I hope you enjoy the book. There's a chapter on David Duval in Breaking the Slump that's really interesting, especially after he seemingly returned from the missing at this year's U.S. Open with a strong finish. Actually, I received an email from a listener last week asking for my predictions of the U.S. Open. And there's no way anybody won any money with that finish. But what I've learned is that from now on, when someone's asking, I'll just put my money on Phil Mickelson to come in second. Ouch. Our quote today is from Jimmy Roberts' book, which is available in the Golfer's Mart of GolfSmarter.com. Appropriately enough, it was David Duval who said, "I think the most precious commodity in golf that needs to be guarded is your confidence." I welcome your comments, suggestions, requests, and quotes. We have many ongoing discussions at our Golf Smarter group on Facebook, or please send me an email by scrolling over the feedback tab to select, "Hey Fred," at golfsmarter.com.